The Jericho Network on Westwood One. All right, today we got the Blue Meanie here. He's talking about ECW. He's an ECW original, a cult favorite. All the gimmick parodies he used to do. Remember the BWO? Or how about the Kiss parody when he was Meanie Simmons? Or how about the Jackson 5 parody? Do you remember that one? I didn't. You'll also hear that whole how it all got started, how the Blue Meanie gimmick got started, how Raven shaped his career. About his original gimmick, the Zebra Kid. Can you imagine Meanie as the Zebra Kid? How about the night he made his ECW debut, and that's the reason he got a debut do-over. Another great story involving Mick Foley, Terry Funk. Meanie's got stories from his WWE run, how he celebrated being signed, the altercation he had with JBL, all the ups and downs and cool, funny stories from the Blue Meanie are here. But before we get into Le Meanie, let me say thanks to all you Talk is Jericho fans for listening twice a week, every week, right, to every show. And thanks for supporting the great Talk is Jericho sponsors who make it possible for me to do this for you for free. That's right, it's free. And that includes my old bud, my good bud, my yoga guru, my yoga Yoda, Diamond Dallas Page, and of course, DDP Yoga. Now, he's given you guys a great deal on DDP Yoga at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. If you're wondering why you always hear me do DDP ads here on this show, talk about DDP Yoga, it's because I believe in this revolution, I guess you'd say, a revolution for your mind, for your body, and basically for your soul. This is the real deal, folks. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. I don't just like the product. What did that guy used to say? Cy Sperling. I'm just not the president of Hair Club. I'm a client as well. Well, there you go. I'm not just talking about DDP Yoga. I actually use DDP Yoga as well, and I want you to do the same thing. I want you to take advantage of the deal that Diamond Dallas Page is giving to all the sexy beast listeners of Talk is Jericho. Plus, he's going to hook you up with 3 free months of the brand new DDP Yoga Now app. Now, this is revolutionary. It's one of the most technically advanced, visually appealing apps that I've ever seen. And as far as getting the job done, everything you need is involved in this app. It's the app I'm using the most on my phone right now. That is the truth. This app is so amazing. I gave it a 5-star review on iTunes. And if you go download it, you'll see that I'm not the only one giving it such great, great ratings. DDP has an Android version of the app as well. And you can get that at Google Play Store. And the best thing about the app is that I can get all the workouts right here on my phone, on my device. Don't have to lug around the DVDs, the DVD player. Those things are becoming as obsolete as an 8-track cassette, man. You even know what those are? 8-track tapes. Do you remember those? Yeah, exactly. That's what you're going to say about DVDs in a few years as well. And you don't have to worry about it because you get every DDP Yoga workout right on the app. The app has live workouts for DDP Yoga Performance Center. Brilliant place in Atlanta. It's got recipes, nutrition guides. You can watch live cooking shows. You can earn rewards within the app and redeem them for some cool prizes and DDP Yoga merch. You guys know what DDP and DDP Yoga did for me, how much I love this program. That's why Dallas has given you such a great deal. He's given you the best price on DDP Yoga at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. And then if you purchase the yoga program at ddpyoga.com/Jericho, you'll get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga Now app. Get started on this today. It's one of the best decisions you can make for your health, mentally and physically. Okay, when I don't do yoga, I start feeling down, depressed, and lonely. I don't want to do that. I want to feel good, man. I want to feel good all the time. I want you to be able to join me. Get started on DDP Yoga. Take advantage of this special offer. Get the lowest price and 3 free months of access to the DDP Yoga Now app by going to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Change your life. Get started today at ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Get in the best shape of your life. DDP is going to take you there, and I'm going to be standing behind you all the way. Go check it out.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The remedy for boredom has arrived. The People's Podcast is here. And let's go for a ride because it's Friday.
It's Friday.
A little old school there. And if you haven't hit that subscribe button on iTunes, what are you waiting for? If you subscribe, you'll never miss an episode of Talk is Jericho. TIJ will be waiting for you every Wednesday and Friday morning like clockwork on the all-day device. Usually, actually, the night before at about 2 a.m. in the morning or so if you're on the East Coast. It's automatically delivered right to the device of your choice. Doesn't get any better than that, but you got to subscribe to do that. You don't have to fumble around. You'll have it right on your device. And while you're subscribing on iTunes, take a minute and leave us a comment and a five-star rating. Benga Mark, Doodles McGillicuddy. It's a great name. Chuck 5363, Jones Jr. 85. Where are you guys getting these names from? And Lupe Roman all left five-star ratings for Talk is Jericho and comments as well. And I thank you for that. Very, very excited to have Blue Meanie here on the show this week. It's been a long time coming, but it's here at last. But before we get the Meanie on, I want to tell you this funny story from last Sunday. So we had a show in Bakersfield, California. Great show. I was working on top, brother, against Bray Wyatt. And the show started at 1 p.m. It was an early show because it was Valentine's Day. Now, it's always stinky to be on the road away from your loved ones on Valentine's Day, but it's what we do. It's what you got to do to make a living. And I was in the dressing room, like I said, at 2:30, and I was on last. And I get a text from Paul Stanley. And this is not a name drop, okay? It's just so crazy. I got this text from Paul Stanley, whoop-de-doo, but Paul and I are friends, and he goes, "Hey, what are you doing tonight?" And I'm like, "I don't know, man. Nothing really. I got this show in Bakersfield, and other than that, I'm pretty free." And he said, "Well, my wife is sick, and I'm going to the Clive Davis Grammy party. Do you want to go?" And I was like, "Okay." And he's like, "Well, meet me in the lobby of the hotel where it took place at 7:15." Now, I finished the match, and I was able to get out of there probably around 4:45 or so, and I was like, what am I supposed to wear to this thing? You know, so I kind of scrounged up. I had a John Varvatos suit jacket, the one I wear without a shirt, which causes so much discussion amongst all of you, which is why I do it. If I can get more people talking about me, why I don't wear a shirt, than actually talking about the main event of Raw, then you know Jericho's doing something right, as always. So anyways, I found the suit jacket. I had a nice button-up shirt, jeans, a pair of boots, and off I go. So I go to the hotel, and I show up in the lobby, and waiting for Paul to get there, and there's like just paparazzi everywhere and fans everywhere, and there's a bar off to the side. So I go off to the side to get myself a yeah boy, and basically just hanging around by myself like the biggest nerd, like just in the corner, like I don't want to bother anybody. Don't really know where I'm supposed to go. Don't really know what I'm supposed to do. So finally Paul gets there, and he's like, "Hey man, come on up to the, you know, there's like a metal detector. Everybody's waiting to get in." So I see him there, and he's like, "Hey, come on up here." So I say, excuse me, kind of bump and push my way through the line. And I get up to where Paul is, and I think, "Hey, I think I just butted in front of Buddy Guy." And we turn around, and it's Buddy Guy standing right there. And Paul's a huge Buddy Guy fan. So we talk to Buddy for a bit and take a picture. And I'm like, "Hey, man, I'm sorry for cutting in front of you in line." He's like, "No problem, man." So then Paul walks the red carpet. I'm like, "Well, what am I supposed to do? Like, do I walk the red carpet here? Like, I've walked a million red carpets, but this is kind of the Grammys and, you know." And then I see these two kind of nerdy people walk the red carpet. I've never seen them before. And I'm like, you know what? If they can walk the red carpet, so can I. So I walk down there. And, you know, of course, you never know if the photographers are actually taking pictures or if they're just flashing. Because that's a trick. A lot of times if people walk the red carpet, they don't know. They just flash. Yeah, camera, so you don't feel too embarrassed. But they don't actually take a picture. But then I did see some pictures of me the next day online. So I was photographed on the red carpet. So that was cool. So then I walked to the end, and Paul's doing a bunch of interviews. So I'm kind of waiting at the end of the line. And, you know, I see Stephen Stills walk by and Clive Davis walks by. And if you don't know who Clive Davis is, he's like one of the most famous music moguls in history, head of Arista Records and J Records and, you know, Whitney Houston and just the list goes on and on. If you want to Google it, like basically anybody who's ever been anybody in rock and roll from, you know, Chicago and Earth, Wind and Fire and Nirvana and the Eagles and Fetty Wap all the way up to, you know, L. Goulding and all those type of people all discovered or Clive Davis had something to do with it. So anyways, so I'm standing there, all these people are walking by and I see Suzanne Somers. I was like, oh my gosh, like if you are a child of the 80s like I am, everyone knows Suzanne Somers. She was like a crush for all of us. She still looks great. And of course, I didn't say anything to her. So then Paul comes over, we walk inside, and there's just like, it's like when I say that everybody was there, I mean everybody was there. And this is no joke. The list of people that were kind of like just kind of wandering around, it blew my mind. It was actually quite impressive of a lineup. I'm just trying to see if I can remember everybody that was there. So Ringo Starr, Sylvester Stallone, who was really cool. I talked to him for a while. Joe Walsh, Suzanne Somers, Jamie Foxx, Irving Azoff, Juliet Lewis, Christina Aguilera, Gwen Stefani, Blake Shelton, Barry Gordy, Michael Keaton, Michael J. Fox, Richard Branson, Caitlin Jenny, Chris Rock, Larry King, Barry Manilow, Jane Fonda, LL Cool J, Lenny Kravitz, Chicago played, Earth, Wind & Fire played, Nirvana played with Beck on vocals, Barry Manilow played, Melissa Etheridge played. And the best part of all is all these fancy pants are there, and they stuck all the rockers at one table in the back. It was me, Paul, Gene Simmons was there with his lovely wife, Shannon, Alice Cooper, Alice's manager, Shep Gordon. I mentioned his documentary, Superman. You got to check that. Sammy Hagar, Chad Kroeger from Nickelback, Avril Lavigne. They have all of us hanging around in the back. It doesn't matter how old you get or how much notoriety or how famous you get. When you stick a bunch of dudes in the back of the room, of course, we're going to start, you know, making comments and throwing little insults and burials towards people. I won't say exactly who we were burying, but a couple of the artists did not really nail it. And we were having a couple laughs back and forth. Actually, Nancy Pelosi, I'm like, Paul, why is Nancy Pelosi here? Isn't she like the Speaker of the House? And Paul's like, no, I think she was a member of Heart. So good times. And Dave Grohl was there. Actually, most of the Foo Fighters were there. Maybe even all the Foo Fighters. And we went to get a shot of tequila, Grohl and I, because we've known each other for years from the Golden Gods days. And the bar was closed, so we greased the waiter $40 for some tequila shots. So Grohl still owes me $20. So I want my $20, Grohl. You son of a gun, you. But yeah, so you know, like, what, it's such a cool vibe, and like, you just see everybody there, and it was a great experience. So I want to thank Paul for hooking that up. And I ended up did meeting Suzanne Somers. If you go to Instagram, you see a picture of me and Suzanne and Paul Stanley, two huge cultural icons, and me. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. But it's, you know, it was cool though. It was a really cool experience, and made some new friends and hopefully some future guests on Talk is Jericho, because that's what I do. You know, whenever I see somebody that I think is cool, I'm like, oh, instantly I'm always thinking podcast guest, podcast guest, podcast guest. And a lot of the people were Talk is Jericho alumni. I mean, Paul Stanley was, and Gene Simmons was, and Larry King was there with his lovely wife, Sean. They were Talk is Jericho alumni. So I did have some steam there. I knew some people. Alice Cooper has never actually been on the show, but he's obviously, like I said, he's my award show friend. So I will get him on at some point by hook or by crook. And I do have the Blue Meanie on. He is on today by hook or by crook. So it's going to be a great show. I mean, he's such a good guy. Very excited to have him.
Talk is Jericho.
All right, sitting across from me, the Blue Meanie.
Yeah, man.
In like this seedy hotel.
When you said, you know, it'd be good to talk about this hotel in a place that's very ECW, my first response was, we probably got kicked out of there. there's somewhere in this area we have been kicked out of.
Well, it's funny because, you know, we're meeting here before the show tonight in Philly.
Yeah.
So I wanted to get a room because I'm going to Pittsburgh after, but I didn't want to spend a lot of money on it. So I just went on a hot wire and looked up, like, was it 2 stars?
And the cute thing was, is like, you're like, you know, it's not a really nice room. And but I didn't want to spend. I was like, dude, look who you're talking to.
I wanted to impress you with the nice room here, you know?
Oh, I know. You know,
but this is, like you said, this is kind of the Philly, this is kind of the epitome of what ECW kind of was.
Yeah.
Not as far as, you know, seedy hotels, but it was very gritty and very dark. And I remember, what was the hotel we used to stay at? Was it the Travelodge?
Oh, the Travelodge. Which I called the Cylinder of Sin. Because, so, like, I remember stories of Jim Cornette talking about, like, back in his day, he would have to... you know, him and Stan Lane would like kung fu kick the door open, just make sure nobody was in there. For the Travelodge, you would have to look and make sure there wasn't like a chalk outline.
It was that bad, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh,
I remember, like, you know, first going to ECW, and I think it might have been one of the first times other than Japan or something where the promoter paid for the hotel.
Yeah.
And the reason why I was able to get Paul to pay for it was I wasn't sure what the deal was.
Right.
And, of course, he never calls anybody back. So I said, I'm assuming you're paying for the hotel. If you don't call me back, then that means you're paying for it. Just wanted to check. Right. Of course, he never called me back. So
it's a good way of calling his bluff.
Exactly. So I get there, and of course, I go to the travel lodge. Like, this is my place. I got a room here. Yeah. And of course, it was like this total, like, if it wasn't a crack hotel, it was pretty close to one.
Yeah, that part of the neighborhood is Philly's so weird. You could be on one block and it's beautiful houses. You go two blocks later and you're like, oh, let me go back home. Yeah. But that hotel was one of the there was some magic to that, because you could go down to the bar, and Paulie was infamous for doing promos till like 6 a.m.
That's right. And we would do them in the Travelodge.
Yeah. Right. He would get that top floor.
Yeah.
You know, where Steve Austin did his famous Monday Night Quill promo and all that stuff. And you'd go to the bar, and you'd have it, put a couple of cocktails in, and then like, so he would send somebody to go look for you, and then you come up to the top floor to the Travelodge, and you do your promo.
And the thing was too, in the bar, all the fans were there.
Oh yeah.
So it wasn't like, not that it's like that now, but you know, you see some fans, you might want to try and stay away there. It's like the fans were a part of the family almost.
It was kind of like, and some of the fans were kind of like sponsors in a way. You know, they would they would get the room for you. They, you know, you'd get to the hotel, you have a tub full of beer waiting for you. Or if you needed a room, sometimes you didn't even need to get your own room. You could just go to a fan's room, shower up there, hang out, and pass out on the couch. And then if Paulie comes to get you for your promo, you do your promo. Go over to the Chinese food restaurant or the diner across the street, and then go to the airport and catch your flight home.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. But luckily for me, it was just like a 5-minute drive.
Right, because you're from Philly.
Yeah, born, partially raised, grew up in Jersey, but Philly's been a huge part of my life and career.
So ECW was the perfect place for you because it was literally right in your backyard.
Yeah, I was born here. I was raised by my grandparents. And then after my grandfather passed away, my grandparents' dream was to retire down the shore. And then they took up raising me, because my mom was a single mom with me and my sister. They said, let's take a little bit of burden off you. We'll raise Brian. So they took, you know, they didn't even have to. They raised me. And then my grandfather had passed when I went to Al Snow School. I was away at Al's for like a month, and my grandma calls, says, you know, Pop's dying, cancer. Mm-hmm. And he's like, but you stay there. Don't give up your dream. Stay there. So Al Snow gave me the blessing. Hey, he's like, hey, man, you've been here for a year. Go back home. Hustle. Now, I'm getting all these bookings, but it helps you to go out there and hustle on your own and establish yourself. So I moved back to Atlantic City. And I'm still doing bookings in like Pittsburgh, Detroit, driving from Atlantic City. And then once my grandfather passed, my grandma was like, no, this whole Atlantic City thing was our dream. Let's move back to Philly. All our family's in Philly. And luckily for me, it's just a perfect time. As soon as I moved back to Philly, I was 21. And that's where I started getting noticed for ECW. So I was doing shows in Maryland. There's three shows. I did a show in Baltimore. A show in a horse barn in West Virginia.
Horse barn?
Yes. Yeah. Where we did a reverse battle royal because the ring broke. So all these professional wrestlers had to act like they've never gotten into a ring before. So the first one to get in the ring won.
Didn't TNA do some kind of a match like that?
I believe so.
They stole it from this.
They probably did.
Yeah. Man.
And then I did a show in Pittsburgh for a guy named Norm Connors. And on all three of those shows was Raven and Stevie.
Mm.
And
what was your wrestling name at the time?
The very creative Zebra Kid, Brian Rollins. I called myself the Zebra Kid because I wanted to have a moniker.
Right.
And I got the idea for the Zebra Kid because when I was going to Al Snow School, we went to, I don't know, do you remember K&H? They made the ring gear?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
They had Carl and Hildegard, it stood for it. They had a...
Oh, I didn't know.
They had a house in middle of nowhere, Ohio, and it's like an hour and a half from Al Snow School. So it was like a class trip, you know. So some colleges take class trips to the museums. He's taking us to go get ring gear in near Columbus, Ohio.
And you're the Zebra Kid.
Yeah. And I was going through the mix match, that like the tights nobody paid for.
Oh, so they already had them made?
Yeah, they had like a grab box of just random stuff. And the place was the coolest thing because, like, you know, I'm just getting into business.
So this is actually a shop where you go in there and they have all the ring costumes and all this stuff.
It's in a house.
Oh, okay.
Like, but they converted the garage into this gear making factory. Mm-hmm. There's sewing machines on the wall. There's photos of Bret Hart. He was sending Christmas cards to them every year because, you know, they would send gear for the kids too and stuff
so
like
they
that.
Made his gear.
Yeah, I saw them making Earthquakes gear and stuff like
that. So they were kind of like the place to go to get your stuff made before they had the seamstresses in the back.
Yeah, when you got into business, you went to K&H for your gear and then you went to B&H or B&M for your boots.
And now it's Stagecoach, right?
Stagecoach. Is now the leader of, you know, the boots. But back then you had to go to, and it was like in Arkansas or something like that. So those are the two companies. So I was going through the you know, misfit trunks, and I saw these zebra tights, and, you know, being a kid in the 80s, I owned a pair of Zubas.
Who didn't?
Yeah. And I was like, you know what? I'll get this. I'll get a singlet over it. You know, I'll be badass. You know, I'm very 80s minded, so I was like, you know, I actually went and got a Zubaz jacket with the Raiders. I took the Raiders patch off, and I had embroidered the Zebra Kid embroidered in the back. Rocket science.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Rocket science, you know. And then I was doing that around the horn, so when Raven and Stevie, I called myself Brian Rollins at the time.
So then Raven and Stevie were on these shows that you were on.
Right. And the third show, they finally said, hey, let's watch this kid. The only reason why I know that is because I did my match, and it was a horrible match. At the time, I had like this buzz cut and chin hair going, and everybody said I looked like King Tut from Batman, which, ironically, I wrestled a guy doing a Batman gimmick.
Of course, he was the good guy.
Oh, of course.
What was his name? Matman?
No. He was brazen about it. He just said, I'm Batman.
Oh, he was the Batman. Okay.
But he was the local guy. He was also Doink. Okay. You know, he
would do whatever had to be done.
Yeah, he had a gimmick table full of other people's merchandise. And, you know, he says to me, kid, I've been in this business a long time. The more they pay me, the more I bump. Tonight, I'm not bumping that much. I'm like, you know, less than a year in the business. I'm like, wonderful.
You're like, all right, Batman.
Yeah. So we had this horrible match, and at least I got to do the moonsault and stuff like that. So,
and let me just phrase this, at the time, in about 94, 95, probably 93, 92 at this point in time.
I started training with Al March of 94.
So, okay, so, but when you're talking about doing a moonsault back in the mid 90s, it wasn't as, now moonsault is a pretty average move. Guys are doing it, girls are doing it, yeah. But back in that time frame, a moonsault was kind of like, and when you did one, being however much you weighed, 280,
I know,
300.
I was well over three.
There you go. To do a moonsault was very impressive.
And I attribute that to guys like Bam Bam Bigelow and, you know, Vader.
Remember the headhunters? They were always flipping all over the place.
Them
too. They were big guys too.
Yeah, and I saw them do it. Bill DeMott, he had a great moonsault.
Yeah.
I mean, Muda was the first one. Lanny Poffo was the first one I ever saw. But he did the one-legged one where the foot was still in the second rope, and then he went
back.
It's like, man, that's impressive. And they didn't even have a name for it yet.
That was
quite a maneuver.
Yeah.
So
you do the moonsault on the show. So what is it that Raven sees in you that makes him want to invite you aboard, so to speak?
They had an idea. Stevie was Raven's lackey. So they wanted to have a lackey to a lackey, like a chain of command of lackeys. Kind of like one of those Russian dolls. One fits into the other one, you know, down the line.
Smaller and smaller.
Yeah, yeah. And then they tried to get me a lackey, and that just didn't work out.
But you kind of had one for a bit, but it was BWO type stuff, right?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. And he had an idea for Stevie to have a lackey. And the guy they had in mind made me look like Sky Low Low. This guy was huge. But he was, you know, he couldn't wrestle. He didn't wrestle. He couldn't bump. And they saw that I was pretty agile for a big guy. And the pitch from Raven the next day was like, you know, kid, we had this idea for, you know, Stevie to have a lackey and a lackey.
Yeah, we got this idea.
Yeah. My voice is gone, or I would have tried the... you're pretty good, and you do a moonsault. You know, you want to be Stevie's lackey. I said, so this means I'll be in ECW. Yeah, I'm in. You'll have to wear a half shirt and Daisy Dukes. I don't care. It's an opportunity,
right?
You know, it's a foot in the door. You know, right now I'm just doing shows.
So where did the character Blue Meanie come from? I mean,
Raven.
We know where it came from. It's obviously from the Beatles.
Yeah,
they were the villains in the Yellow Submarine cartoon.
Yes.
So, but this is Raven's idea.
Yeah. I initially debuted for ECW as just myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was just a guy in a half shirt, Daisy Dukes, and they didn't really introduce me because the night I debuted, it's the night Mick Foley and Terry Funk accidentally set a fan on fire.
They set a fan on fire?
Well, the fan kind of set himself on fire, legally.
What happened?
Welcome to ECW.
Yeah.
Mick wrapped, they were doing a spot, Mick and Terry, where Mick wrapped a chair in a t-shirt, taped it to the chair, lit it, you know, had doused it with whatever fluids, and lit it on fire. So he went to go do this, you know, burning chair shot. Well, not thinking that, you know, fire would melt the tape. The shirt came off and landed on Terry, engulfing Terry. So there was a fan in the front row, and he reached over to try to pat him out.
Oh.
You know, instincts, you go, oh, no, no, no. Well, yeah, you know, he burned his arm up, you know.
Then he catches on fire.
Yeah, so that footage disappeared.
Yeah, so, we saw that again.
Yeah, so I had to re-debut. Well, in that span of a month, you know, Scotty was watching the El Submarine. And again, here comes Norm Connors, the promoter in Pittsburgh, where they initially asked me if I wanted to, you know, be Stevie's lackey. We're driving home from God knows where, Pennsylvania, back to Cherry Hill to where Raven lived. And we're driving through a blizzard. And we're just talking to business. And Raven goes, hey, kid, you ever see the El Submarine? I go, yeah, when I was a kid. He's like, you remember the Blue Meanies? The Blue Meanie? I was like, I vaguely remember. He's like, you're going to be the Blue Meanie. You know, you're going to want to paint your whole, you know, he built it up to where, like, this is the greatest thing. You're going to want to paint your whole body blue. But just do your hair for right now, you know. And I was like, again, I was like, I'm still going to be in ECW, right?
Right.
Right. I'm in. So we drove like 6 hours from Pennsylvania to where he lived. We waited for Blockbuster Video to open, and we went and rented it. And he made me just watch the Blue Meanie parts. And it's Raven was kind of ahead of his time in the fact that
I agree.
He's one of the best minds in the business. But all the stuff they're doing now at the Performance Center now, he was doing back in 95.
In what way?
Like the skull sessions that they do down in NXT at the Performance Center. He would have me study the tape, and then we'd go over Stevie's. He would plop a chair in the living room. I would have to stand there by myself. Meanie, do a promo on toilet paper.
Oh, okay.
Then as the Blue Meanie, I had to describe toilet paper in character. And it was just a bunch of just brain exercises.
Now, did the Meanie kind of have a voice, too?
It was kind of like this.
Yeah, and you hunch your shoulders and kind of like you're sneaking around.
Yeah, like a cat burglar kind of.
Right.
But initially, I was kind of more to the letter of the law of what he saw as the Blue Meanie character. I was like, you know, the Blue Meanie. But then we started doing parodies, and then I started getting kind of lost in the parodies and just became myself.
Because you really, like, even today you show up, you've still got blue hair, you got the blue beard. You really made...
I have to.
Yeah, it's you, right?
Yeah.
But you really became that character, and that's the secret to making it in wrestling, especially when you're playing such a gimmick like this.
Yeah.
You really got lost in the character and committed to it and really made it work.
Yeah. I mean, one of the greatest compliments was when I was in WWE, and they did a profile on me. I think you were on the cover of the magazine. And they interviewed, you know, they're talking about my ECW days and parodies and all this stuff. And they had asked Paul E., you know, about me. He's like, you know, he called me like a method actor, kind of, where he would give me an idea and then he would watch me go off into a corner and just play the thing out in my mind and work over the mannerisms and just try to do it, you know, like De Niro, you know, when, you know, if he, you know, taxi driver, he rode around with taxis for the day, or you just go into that mindset to where you just become the character. And I don't care if they believe the rest of the show, as long as they believe in me,
right?
You know, and stuff like that. So it was just my job to go out there and entertain the fans any way I could.
Well, and that was kind of, once again, I mean, the sign of a great wrestling company, as when the WWE is hot, or ECW at the time. Okay, yes, ECW is known for hardcore wrestling and these classic moments, but it also was very much a variety show, and you had a lot of comic relief, but not stupid comic, legitimately entertaining, funny comedy with you and Stevie doing all of this, you know, of these parodies and all that stuff, because that's what it kind of mutated to. You started out as Raven's flock, I guess,
yeah,
for lack of a better term. There was a flock later. But then you kind of went on your own.
Yeah. He called us the nest.
The nest, yeah. The Raven's nest, yeah.
Yeah, and thank you for that because, you know, if I would have just done everything, done the stuff everybody else on the car was doing, I would just blend it in.
Right.
You know, just, you know, when I started running wrestling, I started promoting shows back in the day, and I always used that ECW plan of, you know, wrestling's like a bowl of Chex Mix. You might not like the pretzels, but hey, you'll like the peanuts. And, you know, if you don't like the peanuts, you'll like the Chex Mix. Or,
right, right. The pretzel things, yeah, the little wheat things, yeah.
Right. On the show, there's got to be a little bit of everything, you know. And we were the Dog and Pony Show, and I owned it. You know, as ridiculous as we can get. And we started doing the parodies. And
so, yeah. So how, what was the first, like, tell me about how the parody started.
We went to pick up Raven at his house, and we're driving, and he's like, you know, he was, you know, Raven's such a student of the game. He just was constantly watching old tapes and stuff like that. And he was watching Memphis and thought of, you know, the Fabulous Ones, Steve and Stan. So he wanted us to come out and proclaim ourselves the new Fabulous Ones. And I would call myself Stan. He would be Steve. And we went and did the Fargo Strut in the ECW Arena. And the crowd just went, oh, come on. You know? It was the worst Fargo Strut. You know, we're trying to do it. And Raven's, you know, Raven's doing it to the T. And we're just, we look like, you know, we're about to have a seizure. You know, it's just, you know, to keep it
as like
PC.
Like robots slurring like,
It's Rock'em, Rock'em, Sock'em.
Rock'em, Sock'em, yeah.
Yeah. And we did it that night. And then, like, from there, he's like, oh, we should do more. So we became the Blue Meanie Bloods. You know,
that was great because that was based on Regal and Bobby Eaton.
And I'm a huge Bobby Eaton mark. Right. So especially the mullet, man. He had the best mullet in the business.
So what did you guys do as the Royal Blue?
I was Sir Meanie, the Earl of Eating, because Bobby was the Earl of Eaton.
Okay.
And he was Lord Stevie. And we had crests on the back of our
this is great.
of our T-shirts. And his was like somebody doing a kung fu kick, and mine was like a plate with a knife and fork, you know, as like crossbones. Yeah. And we got the powdered wigs, and we came out to the, you know, pomp and circumstance type music.
What you doing? Are you doing accents as well?
Oh, yeah.
Like, give me one.
Oh, we did a skit with Todd Gordon where Stevie's trying to pitch everything, and he brings in Sturmey and goes, hello, Mr. Gordon. I, the Earl of Eating, would like to wrestle in ECW. You know, I wish they would put this up on the network. You know, we did a series where he keeps pitching all these different characters, and the third one, you know, I come in as, you know, Sir Meanie, and then he introduces me as Colonel De Meanie, and I come in as a Colonel De Beers.
Yeah.
And the third one, I come in as Blue Dust, and I start sprawling across Todd Gordon's office, and he's like, Richards, Richards, Richards! And it cuts away, you know, and I'm like all like gold dust on the desk.
Oh, that's where you're like, Blue Dust?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he was like, you know, I'm going to, you know, I got all these great ideas, and we took over Todd Gordon's office. If I could find it on YouTube.
What other ones was there? Because you did this for a while, right?
Although, yeah, we did. We did like one stinker, and that was the Jackson 5, and that one just went over like a fart in church. And it got to the point where I was like begging New Jack to pretend he was, you know, outraged by it because he wanted us to wear these Afro. Raven was like, wear Afro wigs, the white shirts, and paint your face black. I was like, no, I share a locker room with New Jack. I am not painting my face black. That man could kill me.
Right.
I went, New Jack, hey, man, Raven wants us to do the Jackson 5, and, you know, he wants us to paint our face black. Can you talk him out of it? He's like, no, I love the Jackson 5. I want to see you do it. I was like, you're not helping me, Jack. You're not helping.
The new Jackson 5.
Yeah. Well played.
Well, then there was the one where you did paint your faces as Kiss. That was a great one.
That was the best one. That I mean, besides the BWO, that was my favorite one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was right when MTV Unplugged came out. And they were just hot, and they're about to go back on tour with the makeup. And, you know, again, Raven was like, do it. And we did a test run the night before the arena at the Lulu Temple.
Plymouth Meeting?
It was Plymouth Meeting.
The only the place of the only meeting between Sabu and Jericho ever, the Lulu Temple. There
yes.
You go.
I was lucky to be there to witness that. That was awesome. But, yeah, the Lulu Temple, which they've gone and sold, and it's become something else now. But we, the first night, we weren't smart enough to do the acrylic paint. Mm-mm. So we went and bought grease paint. Well, it's 90 degrees in the locker room, and it starts running. So for the whole show, we had to find like a meat freezer and stand in the meat freezer for our cue to go to the ring. So we're just standing there like a bunch of idiots, just, you know, shivering and, you know, trying to keep.
So you were Gene.
I was Meanie Simmons.
Meanie Simmons, right.
And Stevie was, you know, Paul Stanley.
Yeah.
We had Nova was Ace. And then Donnie Allen was Peter Criss, who in true Kiss fashion we later replaced with El Puerto Ricano in Long Island.
He became Eric Carr.
No, we kept the makeup.
Oh, you still have him as Peter Criss. He became Eric Singer.
Yeah. Right. Yep. That was in Long Island. And look at confusion on his face because he had never seen Kiss. He's just
right.
He's like, what do I do? Just act like you're playing the drums.
He'd never seen Kiss? No, he's from Puerto Rico, not Zimbabwe.
Seriously, he's just like, oh, this is so stupid, man. What am I doing? And like, just play along, Pablo.
Was he also a Ubaz?
Yeah.
Backwards Sabu?
Yeah. I love you, baby. That was the whole gimmick. He would always hug somebody and tell them that I love him.
I love you, baby. I remember that guy.
Yeah, and Sabu was like, stop hugging me. You know how serious Sabu is? Just go up and hug him. You know? It's just like, I just got the popcorn in this watch.
Yeah, watch Sabu slowly boil. So you put the makeup on, and then you did it again the next night at the arena.
And the next night, the crowd was kind of smarting up to it because some of them had been there the night before. So ECW original, JT Smith, the great JT Smith, comes out, and he's the original member of the Full-Blooded Italian. He's coming out to Fly Me to the Moon. He's like, I got a great new act, you know. And he goes, you know.
He's a black guy playing an Italian.
Yes, yeah. Smarting up the crowd at home. And, you know, some of the crowd that was there like, before you hear subtle chants of, we want Kiss. And then he goes, Kiss. And then, you know, they hit the music and we come out. And it was great until Sandman came out and just waffled us with the.
Yeah, you guys were in the ring playing your guitars and stuff.
Yeah, I'm a good mimic. Mm-hmm. You know, I couldn't play an instrument to save my life. But, you know, I've watched enough, you know, music videos that I can, you know, fake it pretty good. And the cool thing about it is they got this like one angle, and it became like they put it in the opening of the ECW TV show for like a year of where I'm there, and the camera tilts, and I had spit the blood. I couldn't do the fire gimmick, you know, because, you know, we set a fan on fire. So I did the whole food coloring. I came out, I did the Muda thing because I'm a huge Muda mark too. So I sprayed the thing, and as I'm doing playing the bass, I'm let out a little puff of air and goes, and like Paulie saw that and he spliced it to fit the music in the ECW opening,
cool.
Which was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Kiss thing was so awesome because the sign of a good parody is when people just talk about it years later.
To this day,
it's Kiss and BWO.
Right.
And then the cool thing about it is, you know, later on WCW did their version of, you know, the Kiss gimmick. And
the Kiss Demon?
Yeah, the Kiss Demon. And when he did it, I had met him, and he's like, hey, man, I know this isn't as good as yours, but, you know, buttering me up, I was like, dude, you got the the blessing of
you
Kiss.
You got a real costume, too.
Yeah, I could have got sued, you know?
Yeah, especially if Sandman came out at the end and just whacked all you guys with the kendo stick.
And he sings, I'm going to cane your ass tonight, you know?
And then we were talking about the BWO, that was the Blue World Order,
yes.
Which was another parody almost of the NWO, obviously.
Yeah.
Same guys?
Yeah, it was me. Stevie has Kevin Nash, and then we had...
Who are you?
Oh, I was Scott Hall, the blue guy.
Okay, let's say hello to the blue guy.
The blue guy was oozing blue cheese mouth. And Nova was Hollywood Hogan. And the funny thing is, like, you know, it was almost comedic. You know, we're arguing, like, who wants to be who? I was like, no, Stevie, you can't be Hogan. You're taller than everybody. Nash is the tallest. And we're trying to use logic, you know. It's like
BWO logic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like Kangaroo Court, you know? And we finally settled. And then we had, you know, somebody be X-Pac, you know, 7-Eleven.
Donnie Allen.
Oh, no, that was
somebody else?
Yeah, that was Rob Feinstein.
Oh, so, okay, Feinstein played him.
Yeah, and, well, which was a great idea because, you know, at the time, X-Pac had the camcorder. Feinstein was already at ringside recording our shows.
All the stuff, yeah.
So they would just splice his footage into the fan cam footage. So, like, behind the scenes, it was like, I see what you did there. And, dude, that was supposed to be a one-night deal. And it lasted a good 10 to 11.
Even to this day, you gave me a BWO t-shirt when you came in here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What was it like being in ECW at that time? Because that's when it was at its peak. Maybe not, you know, it was before I got TV, before there was pay-per-views, so that might have been a bigger company, perchance. Mm-hmm. But the buzz on the company was massive around 95, 96. Yeah. What was it like to be working there?
It was a blessing, man. You know, I never got paid $1 million in this business, but I got paid in really good experience and good life lessons. Well, the cool thing about getting the ECW, I was watching it before I was even in the business. It started airing it locally here on Sports Channel Philadelphia every Thursday, I believe. And then, you know, it started picking up. And then, like, the first milestone show for ECW was the night the line was crossed. That's the first night they legitimately drew 1,200 fans to see Sabu, Terry Funk, and Shane Douglas in the three-way. But if you watch a lot of those early ECW shows, you see me in the crowd. I just did ECW on Release Volume 3 for the WWE, and I talk about how I was in the crowd for the very first Public Enemy match. And they go through the footage, and they show me in the front row with my, you know, my hair and, you know, marking out and stuff like that. So to be able to go from somebody who was in the crowd every ECW show, I move away for a year to train with Al Snow, and I come back, and I start making trips back home. I'm going to get back to the point, but like,
that's all right, yeah.
I started making trips back home to see my grandfather who was dying of cancer. So I love my grandfather, but I circled those, you know, dates around ECW trips. So yeah. I'd go home for a week, and then, you know, that Friday and Saturday I would see ECW show, and right after the last ECW show I would head straight back to Ohio.
Right back, yeah.
So, you know, I was making my face known, and like Al Snow wrestled for ECW, so I showed up with him once or twice, and one of my my co-students at Al Snow was John Pee Wee Moore. He was refereeing at ECW.
Oh, that's right, yeah. He was like Sabu's guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One time I hung around after a TV taping on a Sunday. He's like, can I go back to Al's with you? It's like, sure. So I hung out and watched guys do promos, you know, and, you know, guys like Taz and Sabu and Paulie kind of Dreamer got familiarized with me, you know, just seen me there. And then I did a show in Michigan for Sabu. Sabu was running NWA Michigan, and you know how wrestling, it's everybody wants to be Vince and stuff like that. Everybody uses the same guys, and they say, well, if you wrestle for me, you can't do that.
Yeah, I got one show a month, but yeah.
Right. Sabu was like, you know what, I'm going to use all Al students, you know, I'm going to use, you know, kid people, you know, I'm going to use wrestlers, you know, that's, you know, fresh to this area.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a show for Sabu where, you know, we were doing a hair versus me and this kid did a hair versus hair match, and we had a double DQ. So we're like, ha ha, we're not getting our head shaved, when technically we should have got both
guys. Yeah,
we're like telling the, you know, crowd, we're not getting our head shaved. Sabu and Paulie hit the ring, and they, you know, Sabu nails me with the chair, nails him with the chair. I feed up. Paulie hits me with the phone. Paulie hits the other kid with the phone. You know, I'm feeding up. I see, you know, the ringside camera guy. So I knew that, you know, to make my facials great and all this stuff. So Sabu starts shaving my head. Paulie shaves my head. So I start showing up to ECW months later. And, you know, once I'm officially in the company, I went up to the TV studios. And Paulie's looking at me. And he's got this look. He goes, you're the kid. We shaved his head on Sabu's show. And absolutely. He's like, hey, like a light bulb went off.
Right,
so
right.
I think he saw, you know, that how, you know,
the potential
persistent I was being. Okay. I was being persistent, you know, but not being annoying about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't like that guy in Goodfellas. I want my money, Jimmy. I want my money, Jimmy. Yeah. Everybody got their money. I want my money, Jimmy. Yeah. And he gets whacked.
Yeah.
I'm here. If you need any help,
you don't want to get whacked.
Yeah. I have my gear in the car if there's an opportunity. You know, and so I start showing up ECW shows. So I got into ECW right at the hottest point. Mm-hmm, you know, it was October 95, the night we set the fan on fire, allegedly. And then November to Remember 95 was the first official appearance of the Blue Meanie in ECW. Right.
Gotcha.
He had me do it on one independent show after that, but then...
That was it, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the thing is, like you said, there was such a buzz about it. Like, if you know, working in Japan, for example, like, the magazines would just be filled with pictures of ECW, and it was almost like you would rather work there than work in WCW.
Yeah.
Or, you know, Smoky Mountain or any place like that.
ECW had that... It had a hip factor to it. It was like, very punk rock.
Good point. Yeah, very punk rock.
It's very. I compare it to the Rocky Horror Picture Show meets the movie Slapshot. And it's just, you know, the fans were the Rocky Horror Picture Show crowd. They knew the chants. They knew the wrestlers. They did the research. They traded the tapes. They went to every screening. You know, you know, their locker room was like Slapshot, and the wrestlers were a lot like the Land of Misfit Toys. And it was. I was just very fortunate. Right place, right time. Because. You know, I live right in South Philly, so I walk around and everybody's like, ECW, and it was like the cool thing, you know. I'd rather have, you know, it's like you got street cred.
Yeah, for being there.
It's some very cool street cred, you know, working at ECW. And
you mentioned that Raven had a lot of ideas. Was Paulie contributing a lot of ideas to you guys as well, or did he kind of leave it up to Raven?
Paulie let a lot of guys just, you know, come up with ideas, you know. He was very open. I mean, if you go to you know, certain shows, you don't see the promoter until after the show. He's handing in your envelopes and stuff like that. Paulie would set up a table right in the middle of the locker room with his pad and paper and just gaze at the room and just feel the room and just individually call people over, you know, have a referee come get you.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And then you wouldn't know what you're doing until you showed up, except for like one time when Raven found out he was wrestling Terry Gordy, and then... You know, Raven knew I was a big Terry Gordy mark, so he was asking me about Gordy and
what does he do, and
what's his moves, what's his do. You know, he does the Asian Spike, and you know. But you know, Paulie was very open. Raven created a lot of characters. He created me. He helped Stevie. He helped Sandman learn how to sell. You know, I mean, say what you want about Sandman, but his psychology got eons better working with Raven every night.
Oh yeah, of course. How could it not?
Exactly. Right. You had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, he created the Dudleys, and he brought pretty much all the girls in except for like Francine. He brought in Beulah, Kimona, and you know, he gave them. He, and when he would call a match, listening to him call a match was like homework. It was and cool homework. I mean, you would learn timing. You know, in moving, they call it beats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he would kind of do that. He's like, I'll shoot him in, count to two, slide in, take the cane shot, powder out. You, Stevie, you see Meanie roll out, you pile in. You know, you get hit with the DDT or whatever. And just hearing him lay out a match, you couldn't help but learn. So, I mean, Paulie was smart enough, because Paulie's a genius in his own, but he was smart enough to know, let other people, you know, contribute to the orchestra.
Who else were like, if Paulie was, let's say, the leader of the team, who else were his like main generals? You mentioned Raven,
Dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
Dreamer was like the mob consigliere. If you had a grievance, he was like the union boss. You know, I really don't feel like doing this kiss spot with Chili Willy tonight, Dream. He'd go to Paulie, he'd come back, he's like, and then Paulie would come over and goes, no, you don't really have to kiss him. You just lean in, put your hand over his mouth, kiss your own hand, and let it go, and then people think you kissed Chili Willy. And then he would explain it in such a way, you go, I'm kissing Chili Willy tonight.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, he was like the union boss, Taz. And then Bubba came along. He started helping out, you know, especially, you know, doing promotions, because he's very intelligent.
He's a great salesman, great businessman. Yeah,
very business savvy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's something we try to teach over at the Monster Factory now, where I'm one of the coaches. You know, you got to be savvy about promoting yourself. You know?
Absolutely.
If you don't promote yourself, why should anybody else?
That's right. The phone's not going to just ring for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Like CM Punk said, you ain't going to change the world sitting on your couch.
Yeah.
So, and, yeah, and then those guys were, you know, the office kind of. You know, little Guido would help out the warehouse. You know, Devon Dudley was helping out the warehouse selling merchandise along with Dreamer. And, you know, Taz designed all the T-shirts.
Oh, Taz did?
Yeah, Taz. Okay. Very talented. You know, like all the logos and stuff.
Oh,
that was all Taz.
All right.
And then, like, you'd order that shirt. You see Taz design. And then it's Tommy, Little Guido, or Devon Dudley packaging it up and mailing
it. Really? So it's almost like a family operation, so to speak.
Yeah, and before that, when Todd Gordon was still with the company, he had an office above his store at Carver W. Reed. And Gabe Sapolsky and Stevie Richards worked there taking ticket orders. So if you called, you were talking to Stevie Richards, and he would make up a gimmick name like Lloyd Van Buren, you know. Hello, ECW, Lloyd speaking.
Art Vandelay.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. And Stevie would take your ticket order, swipe your, you know.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, so I mean, you're working different gimmicks. I mean, you're working your gimmicks in the ring, you're working your gimmicks behind the scenes. Too,
yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, Brad Pitt said, you know, when he wanted to learn how to act, he got a job as a telemarketer, calling people. He would call different people as different characters.
Right.
He'd call somebody with a southern accent, or he'd call this other guy, says, yo, I'm from New York, you know,
kind of. Yeah. Stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, Steve would just have fun with it, just be these different guys. The guy's like, is this Stevie Richards? He's like, No,
it's the exact opposite. Never heard of him.
This is totally not Stevie Richards, the King of Swing, Esquire.
You mentioned Bubba Ray, and something just popped in my head. One of the best scenes was you and Bubba doing the mirror image thing, where you looked at each other and put your right hand. Yeah. You kind of looking. That was incredible. It was
that
a great
that
moment.
Was all his idea. I gotta give him all. And the funny thing, I just saw Bubba 2 months ago.
Uh-huh.
He's on the other side of the. We're at Legends of the Ring convention. He's at a vendor table. I'm at a vendor table. And we make eye contact across the room. I put my arm up, and we both start doing the spot across the room, because to us, that was like one of the funnest things we ever did.
It's great.
It was a nod to the Marx Brothers. Mm-hmm. I think it was Beepo Marx or whatever. The one had the popcorn hair, the blonde hair.
Zippo or?
Yeah.
Beepo, I think, is one of the Mongolians.
Okay, my bad.
I think it's Zippo, yeah.
Yeah, one of them, you know, saw themselves in the mirror and started doing the whole thing. And it was an ode to the Marx Brothers. And again, that was at the Cylinder of Sin at the top of the Travelodge at like 3 in the morning. You know.
Whatever it would be,
Yeah.
What? When did because were you in ECW until the end? Were you there the whole time? It was on TV and everything, or
I was there from October '95 until November of November '98.
Oh, okay, so you were gone a few years before.
Yeah, yeah. I almost went to WWE a little bit earlier, but then that got botched. And then, like, later on, I got a call from Al Snow saying, hey, you work in ECW? I'm like, yes. And he goes, how are you under contract? I go, no. He goes, how loyal are you to Paulie? I was like, well, no. I like working here, but what's up? He's like, if you had an opportunity to be in the WWE and be a part of the Jobs Guy, would you do it? I was like, absolutely, you know.
Oh, okay.
And it's like kind of like cloak and dagger, you know. Because one time I was supposed to come – one time I was at home and I was on AOL back in the day, and I get an IM from Al Snow going, where are you? Where were you? I go, what are you talking about? I'm home. He goes, you were supposed to be at TV Monday. I go, what are you talking about? He's like, your name was on the lineup sheet. They had music for you. They had an entrance planned.
For WWE?
Yeah, in Baltimore.
Huh.
And you weren't there. I was like, I said, Al, you know me. If there was an opportunity to do that, I would have been there. He goes to Vince Russo. It turns out WWE asked Candido if they could use me, because they wanted to do a parody of the Nitro Girls. I was going to be the Raw Boy, you know, because I was already doing the parodies.
Right.
So they want me to come in and do the whole dance routine and stuff like that. And then, you know, Candido said Paulie told me to show up to the TVs, and they never told me. So it was like a rib on WWE.
Oh.
So the next time, you know, and, you know, Al went to Vince Russo, explained the whole thing, and squashed it. So I didn't look bad. I didn't get, because that could have hurt my career, you know.
Sure.
We had to give this guy an opportunity.
Oh, yeah. He didn't show up. Right. Yeah,
that could have killed me.
Yeah.
But, you know, this time, Russo went to Al. Al went to me. I said, absolutely. And, of course, I tried to call Paul, and Paul didn't call me back. Dreamer called me back. It's like, hey, man, you got to do what you got to do. You know, you might not be the next Rock, but it's an opportunity to help your family and Tommy.
Sure, of course.
And then I called my tag partner, Nova. I didn't want him finding out online, you know. I said, hey, man, I got this opportunity. And he was driving to the next town because That weekend they were in Florida, and he drove down with the sound guy to save money on the trans. And I would fly down, and then I said, man, this – like, go do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cool thing is later on that night, he called me from the locker room, and they passed the phone around to all the boys.
Oh,
and
that's
the,
cool.
And all the boys said, congratulations, go do it. You know, and kill it. And,
which is, I mean, that helps. You know, you're gonna do it anyways, but that helps that you get the blessing of your peers.
Exactly. I mean, and that's another thing about ECW, you know, the locker room. We all looked out for each other. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, we were competitive. We all wanted to have the best match on the show and steal the show. But, you know, ultimately, like, if I came back from the locker room, Bigelow would pull me aside, be like, you know, I saw you a little winded out there. You're a big guy like me. If you're going to go out there, have a strong set of wheels, man. Just get on the bike, do some cardio, strengthen your legs. You know, I know you got an image to, you know, keep up, but, you know, he's like, there's nothing worse than, you know, sucking wind and your legs feel like rubber bands. He's like, I'm telling you, man, it's big, man. Keep your wheel strong.
Right.
And guys would pull, you know, Tommy Rich would pull me aside and give me advice after a match because we wrestled the FBI every night. We were wrestling Tracy Smothers, who's awesome. He's an unsung hero. There's a lot of unsung heroes in ECW. Tracy Smothers is one of them. Little Guido and Tommy Rich. And that learning tree was phenomenal. You know, and then we go in the back and they would pull me aside and critique the match. Yeah, you had instant feedback.
Right. From guys that had some really good experience.
Yeah. I mean, Raven would teach classes on promos. He'd bring in, like, you know, Continental Wrestling and, you know, Danny Doring, Chris Chetty, Roadkill. I would go in there, Nova, and we'd watch it. And as the match is going on, he would pause it and explain what's going on in the match and the psychology of the match. And, you know, and he would do the skull sessions with the ECW kids, you know. Here's a topic. Cut a promo.
Right.
And this is all the way up until he went to WCW. He was doing this with the young guys. So all the veterans were helping the young guys.
Who were some of the other unsung heroes in ECW? You mentioned Tracy Smothers being one of them.
Tracy Smothers would take all the boys in the ring before the show, do calisthenics, do drills, you know.
Kind of Japanese style.
Yeah. And then you would have a dark match, technically, in front of just the boys.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, just work it out. Tommy Rogers, God rest his soul, who just passed away.
Mm-hmm.
He was very instrumental in helping a lot of the young guys, and he would tag with like Chris Chetty and stuff like that. And
he was a great worker.
Underrated. Yeah, and he was good with pulling the boys aside too. Tommy Rich would pull the boys aside. Unsung heroes like, you know, Ron and Charlie, who would, you know, work ungodly hours to make sure the TVs were edited.
What's his name?
There's
Ron and Charlie.
Ron Buffone and Charlie. Who
were they, like, producers of the show?
Yeah, Charlie was at ringside with the, you know, the handheld, and
okay,
and then Ron would be up with the hard cam, and you know they would, you know, tape the show, rush to the hotel with the cameras, tape the show, edit all day Sunday, Monday, till like to break it down, and then they would have the TVs shipped to every television station, so we made air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure there's, you know, Bob Ortiz and his wife Lex in the early days of ECW. ECW was born on the concept of filling the void, because there's initially a wrestling promotion before ECW called Tri-State Wrestling Alliance. Joel Goodhart and Todd Gordon was one of the financial backers. For a reason, you know, Tri-State closes. It's kind of explained on the DVD I gave you. And then one day, Todd Gordon, Bob Ortiz, who was, you know, the ECW ring announcer, his wife Lex, and Larry Winters, who's another unsung hero to the Philly area, they all came up with the concept of ECW. They're like, let's just run some shows.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they all became...
Because there was a big area, like you said, open hole in the market for shows. Yeah,
yeah. Other than that, there was, you know, Dennis Corluzzo would run NWA.
Yeah, of course, Cruise, right.
And that became a little rival.
For a little while, NWA. Yeah. You're talking about ECW being kind of a family organization, then you're going to the biggest family organization, going to go work for the McMahons and work for Vince. How was that for you to make that transition from ECW and walk into the doors of WWE?
I got a great story, because I almost blew it my first weekend in, but the coolest thing is I got the call from Al. 2 hours later, Bruce Pritchard calls, gets all my vitals, my social security, all that stuff. Okay, show up Sunday. And the coolest thing was leaving my bedroom, walking 20 feet to the living room where my mom and my grandmom was. I said, well, put all the bills in my name. They're like, why? I said, well, I just signed with the WWF, and my knee, my grandma's knees almost buckled. She went, what? I'm going to wrestle for WWE. And just the look on her face was worth its weight in gold, because up until, you know, people are like, oh, I paid dues in the business. My family paid dues in this business supporting my hobby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they, you know, when I was off playing wrestler for $50, they were, you know, making sure there was food on the table, roof over my head.
Right.
I'm paying it back now in spades.
Mm-hmm.
I put everything in my, I paid for all the bills. I paid for all our medicine and all this. So the fact that I would, you know, got the, you know, you said I would go work for another family company, which gave my family, you know, the best. My grandma had passed 2 years later, but I gave her the best last 2 years of her
That's
life.
That's great. Yeah.
And I, you know, I will never fault the, you know, any WWE for anything. You know, they eventually released me. And
but you were there for a while though.
2 years.
Oh, was it 2 years? Okay.
Yeah, I showed up. I debuted on Sunday Night Heat. I did a. Did a run in to help Job Squad member Gilbert. Gilbert was wrestling.
Who was on the Job Squad? Al?
Al, Gilbert, Scorpio, Bob Holly. And then I was like the last one in. And then it disbanded after that.
Right.
But, I ran in to help Gilbert try to beat, you know, Christian. And then the Brood runs in and we have a big brouhaha and stuff like that. So I debuted that weekend. And being typical indie wrestler, I'd like, okay. I will wrestle Philly. I'll drive to Baltimore. Raw's in Baltimore. They had to Raw, and then they do Raw on Tuesdays, and that would be the tape delay Raw the next week. So the next one was in like Hartford, Connecticut. So I was like, you know what? I'll just drive to Hartford right from Baltimore. And then Earl Hebner was like, no, dummy, we fly you now. So I was like, okay, excellent. So I rode down to Baltimore with Al. I was traveling with Al Snow, Mick Foley, and Bob Holly. Go to Baltimore. Do Raw. I do a spot where I run in to help Dwayne Gill beat Mark Mero.
Mm-hmm.
I shove Mark Mero off the top rope. He pins him 1-2-3. And then the next morning, we go to fly to Hartford. We get to the airport, and I go to the ticket counter. Get my ID, answer the three stupid questions that I don't ask anymore. And I was like, man, seat 1A. That's first class. I was like, I go to Al. I go, that's pretty close up front of the plane, ain't it? He goes, oh yeah, that's first class, all right. I'm like, and I got like this knot in my yeah. stomach.
Only in wrestling could you feel bad about getting a first class
yeah.
seat. Yeah.
So I'm like, oh. So I get on the plane, and I kind of like pop my collar up. Hopefully nobody sees me. I get in my seat. I'm sitting right next to the boss man, Shawn Michaels, and Sergeant Slaughter. So I'm like, oh. And then guys are walking on the plane and they're like looking at me, giving me the fish eye. And I knew I was in trouble when Mick Foley got on the plane, looked at me and went, oh, Meanie. Oh no. Meanie, no. Oh, I go, help, 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 Mick. Yeah, I didn't know what to do.
Right.
You know, I wasn't used to flying.
Yeah.
ECW just drove.
Yeah.
And they only flew me like the last couple months of my tenure there. Mm-hmm. So we get off. We go to the baggage claim. You know, China's. Oh, no. During the flight, I'm sitting there, you know, trying not to have a nervous breakdown, you know, and, you know, talking to boss man and stuff. And I hear, why the fuck is the Blue Meanie in first class? And I'm like, oh, I just, if there was a door next to me, I would just open it and
just did, jump out.
Yeah, and done the nesty plunge out the door.
Who yelled it out?
I don't know.
It's somebody,
But I get off, you know, China's giving me the eye, like, how could you?
Mm-hmm.
Mark Henry's like, you done fucked up, man. And we get to the baggage claim, and like, D'Lo's like, I would have gave my chair to a veteran. I turned out, why didn't you tell me?
Yeah.
So we're driving to the building, and I'm just like, the whole time I'm like, hey, Al, nobody's going to shit my bag tonight, are they? And Bob Holly's like, I don't think they shit in bags anymore. I think we moved on to other things.
Yeah. Now we just bury you and get you fired.
Yeah. So I get pulled into an, like, the whole time I'm like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. I get pulled into an office with Jerry Briscoe and Jack Landon, and I love Jerry Briscoe.
Yeah.
We just had him at the Monster Factory for a seminar, and he was just like, Meanie, I know you're new here. I know you made a mistake. We know you won't make that mistake twice. I went, absolutely not. And then Bob Holly spoke up and said he's genuinely sorry, you know. And
that's cool that Bob Holly was sticking up for you, because he's a pretty pretty mean guy.
He's an intense dude.
Yeah.
But for some reason, I just made him laugh.
Mm.
And then, I really got my break with WWE. One weekend, I showed up to a house show that I wasn't even booked on. I just went to say hi. And Pat Patterson was there and says, "Hey, do you have your gear?" I went, "Absolutely." He's like, "Go get your gear. You go to the ring with Job Squad." I was like, and I managed the Job Squad, which was Scorpio and Bob Holly against Edge and Christian. So from there, something happened where they let Scorpio go. So I filled his spot in on the road. There, and that's where I started making the real money.
Mm-hmm.
And it was me and Bob Holly against Edge and Christian for a good loop. And then sometimes they would break it up where it's just me and Christian for a good couple months. And
nice.
I was having the most fun of my life there. And, you know, Bob, you know, like teaming with me. I like teaming with Bob because it was two contrasting styles.
Right, two styles, yeah.
And the thing is, we would shoot Edge and Christian in the thing, and he'd go to whip me into them to do the double splash. And I legit didn't have to run. He just pulled me and
threw you right across.
It's like, sling.
So you mentioned how you had that time in WWE, but then you came back for the one-night stand pay-per-view.
Yeah, flash forward to 2005.
Which was a huge deal and still a pretty cool moment, because it was the one time that Vince actually like embraced the ECW culture,
yeah,
and acknowledged it, and actually was a pretty damn good show.
Yeah, and I mean, everybody's depressed ECW went out of business the first time. I don't think they were. I mean, they were depressed that they were no longer going to be working, but the last show was in like Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had done the arena the week before. If you're going to have the, you know, if you're going to close shop, do it at the arena.
Yeah, not in Arkansas.
Yeah, yeah, Bowleg, Arkansas, wherever it was, I forget.
Right.
And then, you know, a lot of guys were just like really bummed out. And, you know, I call those the year from 2000 to 2004 my dark years. I just battled depression and kind of lost my way, you know, especially with the Meanie character, because I'd lost 160 pounds. WWE asked me to lose 160 pounds, and then they still fired me.
Yeah.
So.
They asked you to lose the weight, and then when you lost the weight, they fired you?
Yeah.
Oh.
They teased my release the first time, and Kevin Kelly asked me to come on Bite This, their cyber show at the time, and he's like, you know, during the course of the interview, sorry you let go, but you'll lose the weight next time, right? I was like, oh, so this is all about getting me to lose weight. Mm. So. JR called me. There's been a reprieve from the warden. He's going to keep you around. And I was like, all right. So I was like, I started losing the weight. And I started going to Headbanger Mosh's brother, who's a nutritionist, mm-hmm. right over here in Jersey. I dropped like 160 pounds within a good 7 months.
Wow.
And they sent me to Memphis because I didn't look like the meanie anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to do like this gimmick where I grew like the thin beard, and I got the spiky hair. And the big band at the time was Smash Mouth, and he had and he had the cool button up shirt, like bowling shirts. And
he was kind of a bigger guy.
Yeah, too. I was kind of working towards doing that. And then my grandma got sick.
Okay.
So I was like, hey, can I go see my? She got pancreatic cancer, and she didn't have much time. So I, you know, drove back to Philly, and then you know, they eventually let me go. Which I totally get, you know, it's right. Business. So, you know, I go back to ECW for that short run, and then ECW closes. I had a chance to go to WCW.
And then they closed.
Stupidly, I should have went to WCW, but it's like trying to choose between the Hindenburg or the Titanic.
You're right. Yeah. You know? You're screwed either way.
I was like, if I'm going to go down with the ship, I'll go out with my friends in ECW. Yeah.
So what happened when I stand with you and JBL?
Oh,
was some kind of a fight or something like this, right?
Well,
has that been overblown, or is that legit?
I'll preface this that we've worked out everything.
Oh, okay,
we're cool now.
Cool.
But like during my whole tenure there, you know, from 98 to 2000, it was just like, I don't want to say hazing, but it was bullying,
mm-hmm.
you know, whether it be, you know, taking shots in a match, you know, and, or we'd be on a plane and, you know, he's telling a story about some fat fuck and, you know, he's referencing you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
that was kind of JBL at the time. He was very bully-esque.
Yeah, he was talking about Vader to Matt. He's like, him and Matt Hardy were behind me. He's like, yeah, look at that Vader doing a moonsault with funny hair. Imagine a big fat guy with funny hair doing a moonsault. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, he's talking about me, and I'm not going to sell it.
Right.
You know, grip my teeth. I have a family to support. I'm not going to start a fight. I'm just going to buy my time. I only have to see him at the arena. So my whole 2 years, it was like that, you know. And then, like, you know, we'd work, we worked the loop, and, you know, I'm walking home, like, I, somebody tell these guys it's fake. Which is, it's not, I mean, it sounds crazy coming from a guy who worked in ECW.
Well, ECW didn't necessarily mean being stiff, though.
Right.
It just meant, you know, it was hardcore, but like it wasn't that you're punching each other in the face
right.
as hard as you can.
Right.
You
know, it wasn't like Jackass.
There's a difference, right.
You know, you get rabbit punches to the base of your skull, and I'm like, what the fuck's going on? I just want to work and go home and alive. Mm-hmm. So I did an interview when I left WWE. I said I had a great time in WWE. I saw the world. You know, Vince, I got paid to see the world in Vince McMahon's time. I thanked WWE. I was like, the only thing is, you know, JBL was kind of an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And that soundbite became, it's like I talk about the grapevine a lot. And like I say, I'm one of the coaches of Mods Friday. I tell people, watch what you say, especially now today is social media where everybody can just take your words and distort them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for people who don't know what the grapevine is, you know, in grade school, like third grade, the teacher would whisper something in your ear. You turn around, whisper it to somebody else, and by the time it gets to the 30th,
like the campfire game.
Yeah, yeah, there's a great scene like that in Johnny Dangerously, where, you know, Johnny and the Mothers are playing the Savoy tonight. You know? But it's like that, and I said he was a bully, and it probably said, you know,
he's the biggest. Yeah, whatever. Kill him. Yeah, right. Yeah,
whatever. However, got to him. So we get to One Night Stand.
And this is, you're hired for one night, basically.
Yeah.
They bring in on a one-night deal.
Yeah. I was kind of depressed when they announced it, and I didn't get called to do it till like 2 weeks before.
Oh, okay.
I'm like, oh, man, are they going to call me? But they called me, and I was relieved, and then we get there. And I saw John before that thing, you know, hey, John, how you doing? Hey, Brian, how you doing? And we even practiced the deal where the ECW guys faced off with the WWE.
It's a big schmoz at the end, right?
Yeah.
Or in it.
It started with.
At the beginning, whatever.
Yeah. We didn't do anything until Kurt Angle and Taz start throwing punches and then.
You know, then it's a brawl.
I'm sorry?
Then it's a brawl.
Yeah. Yeah. So, like, you know, we're just doing, like, come on, tough guy. Dude, I'm going to beat you up. You know, that kind of stuff back and forth. So we practiced all that. Flash forward to the show. And we go to do it, you know, I'm like looking at, you know, like one of the bastions. I'm like, oh, look at you, cue ball, whatever, blah, blah, blah. See Bradshaw, hey, cowboy, I'll kick your butt, you know, all that stuff. And then, like, he stopped and, like, looked at me. Like, he was a bull, and I was wearing a red shirt. And I went, oh, shit. I was like, I just said something about his hat. And, you know, like, the brawl breaks out. And before, I'd playing with Danny Basham. I was like, yeah, we're never going to work with each other again. Let's just throw a couple hands, whatever. Mm. So we're throwing hands. Now, 2 nights before, there was an ECW reunion show thrown by Jeremy Borash. And during a spot with Raven and Sandman split me wide open with a chair. So I had like this crescent moon scar, which I had like 8 staples there.
Okay.
And like, the last two, you definitely could tell the guy didn't Novocaine me up.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we're there. I had the crescent moon scar. I feel this punch right on the scar.
Ugh.
And I go, what the hell? I turn around. There's JBL, and he starts throwing shots, and does the hockey thing. He pulls my shirt over my face, starts throwing, you know, live rounds. He's got a fistful of rings, and so I was like, I ain't going to take this. So I just snatched a headlock, you know, as much as I could on a 6'6 man. And I started throwing punches back. And we kind of get pulled apart. You know, Benoit walks up to me and, you know, everybody thought I bladed it. And they're like looking at me. Benoit's looking at me. I was like, JBL just shot on me. So he goes, powders off with somebody. Tracy Smothers like, Manny, what happened? And everybody's coming up. What happened? I was like, him. He just shot on me. And at the end, if you see it, Sandman wraps his cane around JBL, and Tracy Smothers comes off and start laying haymakers.
He's like,
and Bubba Ray reaches in and yanks him out and says, you know, get to the back.
Right.
So we're doing a celebration. I'm a bloody mess, but I was like, you know what? I'm in the ring with Steve Austin. You know, we're just drinking beers. I just put a beer on my face and drink the other one. We do the celebration. I go back, and Johnny Ace meets me at the curtain. He goes, what the hell was that? I was like, what? I was like, JBL shot on me. He's like, or no, he said, who told you could blade? I was like, I didn't. He's like, what? I gave him the elevator pitch of the heat that we had, you know. I was like, hey, this, that. He's like, that's unacceptable. We don't do that here, blah, blah, blah. And I walk further into the gorilla position, and there's JBL. He's like, you were talking about me on the internet. I was like, crap. I was like, dude. Was I wrong? You're having a hard time proving me wrong here. So, you know, long story short, like, I went, well, WWE did the right thing. They stitched me up. They gave me, you know, they doubled my pay for that night.
Oh, that's cool, yeah.
Yeah, like, Hebner came and found me, and he had paid me earlier. He's like, here's another X amount.
You know that's coming from the top.
Yeah. I said, thank you. You know, and on the way home, I drove up there with Francine, referees Jim Milo, and John Finnegan, because they live right around here. And they were going to pull over and take me right to the emergency room, because I was, like, kind of blacking out in the car. And the next day, I took the photo. I posted it online. And, you know, the internet ran with it. And then I was like, you know, the more people were like, you know, that's effed up, I started getting angry. The point I got the angriest is when I had to go down to the living room and my mom had to see my face.
Oh, yeah.
So I had, you know, not only did I already have the thing in the back of my head, but I had this huge Frankenstein stitch down my hair. My eye was out. And my mom looked at me and she winced and turned her head. And I was like, I said, F that. You know, fuck that. So I kind of started writing blogs about it. I was like, you know, there's a trust in this business. You know, I'm feeding you my body and you're, you know, blah, blah, blah. A couple months later, maybe a month later, 2 months later, Dreamer calls me. He goes, hey, man, we want to bring you in, you know, do this show. We're switching Stevie from Velocity to SmackDown. We kind of, and this was talked about at One Night Stand because Nova, who was a member of the BWO, was off in the office at the time. He's like, we're kind of talking about bringing you back in. Dude, you know, have, you know, the BWO be the catalyst from Stevie going from Velocity to SmackDown.
Mm-hmm.
So this was kind of, you know, it was in the talks, but like the whole JBL thing pushed it to the front burner. So, you know, famous words, Tommy goes, this has nothing to do with JBL, man. we're just bringing you in, do the things. So I get the TV. I see Johnny, and I'd say hello, everybody. I see Johnny Ace. He's like, yeah, you're working Bradshaw tonight. I went, son of a bitch. I was like, yeah, I was like, Tommy. But I was like, so I went, really? He's like, yeah, you're going to do the moonsault. You're going to go over. I was like, does John know this? So, and then John shows up, and he's behind me, and, like, his cowboy hat was pretty much like the dorsal fin in Jaws, like, doom, 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 doom,
yeah, right.
Doom, doom, doom. And I tensed up. I was just, like, bracing myself just in case, you know, another haymaker came. Long story short, they explained the thing, and then Bradshaw comes up and goes, you want to talk? I was like, absolutely. So, you've been to TVs, and, you know, when you're in the back, you see, there's all this signage, you know, catering, Vince's office, seamstress, blah, blah, blah. So we start walking to a part of the building where I'm seeing less and less signs. I'm like, oh, man, I'm getting whacked. If we go to a room and there's plastic on the floor, I'm running. You know, this is like good for like Joe Pesci and Goodfellas. Yeah,
right.
He thinks he's getting made. So we go in a room. He locks the door behind me. And I kind of like took a step back. He goes, you know, we can, you know, make money, or, you know, we can fight, or we can make money on this. I was like, well, I never wanted to fight you, John. And I said, truthfully, I was a fan of yours before all this happened. You know, I saw him in Global Wrestling Federation. I was a huge fan when he came to WWE, and he was with Zeb. And I was like, yeah, you're like the new Stan Hansen. I was a huge fan of yours, and I was really disappointed when everything happened between us. And I said, you did this, that, this, and then the other thing. He goes, quite honestly, I don't remember any of it because, you know, you hear, you know, this people are different, and he might have been, you know, a different guy back then. He probably didn't remember. I took him at his word. You know, I'm not in this business, you know. The worst thing you could ever do in life is hold a grudge.
Of course.
It doesn't hurt the person you have the grudge with. It eats away at you.
At you, right.
It becomes like a cancer in you. Mm-hmm. It just eats away at your soul. And the most invigorating feeling is when somebody says, I'm sorry, and that burden comes off your shoulder. And I shook John's hand. I said, look, man, I was always a fan of yours. He's like, well, let's make some money off this. Let's go in the ring tonight. I have a good match. And from then on out, we went to the ring. We had a good match. And then flash forward 10 years later, you know, I did a couple more TVs for them. And then the BWO wrestled the Mexicals, the Great American Bash. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my time was up. Flash forward years later, I'm on Twitter, and it says, at JC Layfield is now following you. I went to see if it, you know, because like fans make up their own.
Right, yeah, yeah, that's him though.
And it was him. And a fan pointed it out, goes, am I seeing things, or did Jay Bale just follow the Blue Meanie on Twitter? And he goes, I love Brian. I think he's great. I think he's funny. And from that ugly incident
right.
to now, you know, we're Twitter buddies.
And that's how you become friends nowadays.
Yeah.
The ultimate in friendship, right?
Yeah. You can make friendship with somebody, you know, once you make money with them.
Yeah, so, yeah. And be on Twitter.
Yeah.
And follow each other on Twitter.
And the coup de grace was, you know, this last year he tried to get me in the Royal Rumble since it was in Philadelphia.
Oh, that's cool.
He lobbied. He's like, because I had just filmed ECW Unreleased Volume 3 for the WWE. Mm-hmm. What better way to announce that the DVD's coming out
than have you come to the ring?
An ECW original in Philadelphia, yeah. Come into the ring. Here's the new co-host, you know, hosting with Steve Richards and Joey Styles, the Blue Meanie.
Yeah.
I tried to get me and Stevie, and then, like, you know, I think, you know, due to, you know, trying to save money on flights or whatever, John just said me, and came down to that Friday before, and they picked Bubba.
Oh, okay.
So, I love Bubba. So,
no, of course.
I marked out for seeing Bubba come to the ring, too. Man. But it was cool. It was close.
Great stories, man. But last question. What's your favorite match that you've ever had, if you had to pick one?
Oh, my God. There's favorite matches and there's favorite moments. You know,
give me a couple.
I mean, the number one moment was, I'm in the ECW for a couple months, and Mick Foley's getting set to go to the WWE. And he comes up to me and Steve, and he goes, yeah, guys, I got this this plan for you to be a part of my farewell. And me and Stevie are, like, looking around, like, is he talking to us? And then, like, we turn around. He's like, no. He liked what we did. And he did his match with Mikey Whipwreck, got on the mic, and he was going to, you know, say his gave his farewell speech, and he wanted to bring two guys to the ring, and this whole build-up sounded like Paulie and yeah. Todd Gord come out, and me and Stevie come out, and we did the Fargo strut.
Together, I remember.
Yeah.
That was one of my first shows, was It Mix Last.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we recently just recreated that. We had a show where we celebrated his birthday. He's like, I want to recreate a moment that lives in ECW infamy. And he does this whole James Brown type, like, I'm not leaving until we do it kind of speech. And we go out and we recreated it.
And it's you guys.
Favorite match? I mean, any match I had with, you know, Tracy Smothers, Little Guido, the FBI, and ECW. And then when I got to the WWE, I loved working with Edge and Christian. You know, those guys were so good. And we're all just young. And
yeah.
Just
open to anything.
Just having fun.
Yeah.
I do a spot where, you know, we do the crisscross. I go, stop! I do the meanie dance, you know, do the, you know, the spin around, and then he would just drop kick me in the mush, you know, and then he would do the meanie dance and this cool stuff. Like, hey, working with I loved working with the vets and learning, I liked working with the guys who were around my age and wanted to do the same things. And that's how it was in ECW and then with WWE. And, you know, I'm in a good place right now. I went through a lot. Wade Keller from the Torch calls me the Forrest Gump of wrestling because I've kind of been there for a lot of big moments, good and bad.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I was there when, you know, they set the fan on fire. I was there when, you know, this and that happened. But, you know, I'm in a good place now. I'm coaching and, you know, I'm giving back to the business that gave so much to me. You know, I'm over at the Monster Factory in Paulsboro and, to be able to tell the kids, you know, teach them what, not only what to do, but teach them the mistakes I made, you know, and, you know, pass it along, you know, and it's some of the greatest stuff.
So then you should be they should be listening to you when it comes to characters, because one of the best characters.
Well, thank you.
That came out of nowhere, the Blue Meanie.
Man. I appreciate that, brother.
Glad we could do this today.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me.
Shaking hands.
Yeah. It's an auditory thing, but we're shaking hands like. But thank you so much.
Hey, I want to send out heartfelt condolences to the Blue Meanie, real name Brian Heffron. His mother passed away last week after a long illness, and a GoFundMe page has been set up to cover her funeral expenses. You can find the link on Blue Meanie's Twitter, at Blue Meanie BWO. If you got a couple bucks to kick in, Meanie is a great guy, and he totally deserves it. So help out Mrs. Meanie, the recently passed Mrs. Meanie, and go check that out, at Blue Meanie BWO. Help out if he can. And I got to say thanks to helping me out for supporting this show, supporting my sponsors. I wouldn't be able to do this twice a week for free without all of you and all of my great sponsors, including the one that's been with Talk is Jericho since the beginning, Amazon. You can find the Talk is Jericho Amazon links by going to podcastone.com, clicking on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. I got Amazon links for the USA, UK, Canada, A. Every time you use the Talk is Jericho Amazon link, Amazon kicks back a small percentage to the show to help us cover costs, which help us keep this on the air for you for free. It's very, very important. If you're going on Amazon, which everybody does, please go through the Talk is Jericho link. As a matter of fact, if you go buy something from Talk is Jericho link on Amazon, post what you bought and post it on Twitter at Talk is Jericho on the Twitter, and I will retweet it and I will follow you because I want to see what kind of cool stuff you guys are buying on Amazon through the Talk is Jericho links. Now remember, when you use this, there's no hidden fees or extra charges. You buy just about anything you can think of on Amazon and usually at the best price, and you're helping out this show as well. Once again, podcastone.com. Click on the Killer Deals button in the top right corner of the page, then hit the Talk is Jericho button. Then take a picture of what you buy, post it on Twitter at Talk is Jericho, and I will retweet and follow you. Sound good? All right. And don't forget about my great sponsors, TrueCar, Geico, Uber, DDP Yoga, featuring the DDP Yoga Now app. And if you go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho, you'll get the best deal on the most amazing fitness program in the world today. And you get 3 free months of the DDP Yoga app. Okay. Thank you for listening. Keep on listening for the 60-second AP news headlines coming up next. And next Wednesday. All right. Very, very huge requested. It's not just one guest, it's two guests. One of the top tag teams in the world today, maybe the top tag team in the world today, and they're not in the WWE, they're not in TNA, they're in Ring of Honor, they're in Japan, they're called the Young Bucks. That's right, the Young Bucks are going to be here, Matt and Nick Jackson, next Wednesday by popular demand on Talk is Jericho. And what a cool group of guys they are, a couple of good dudes. We're going to talk all about their career on Wednesday, and I expect to see you there. Want you to join us. We'll see you on Wednesday. Stay hard, stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy!
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.